one of the technical marvels of the Allies was self-eating soup, you see. So he, all these wretched soldiers down in the troop space, he went down the ladder with this thing. And of course, there were a couple of his sailors up on top with their machine guns, keeping them under surveillance. And when he pried the lid off this thing, I think they must have thought it was a bomb.
Yeah.
Because they made a mad rush for the ladder and sort of ran ran right over him getting up, and the sailors had a hell of a time controlling them, and poor old John was sort of knocked out. It was really quite funny, actually. He made it back the next day. A little bit the worse for wear. Anyway, we were very lucky in our flotilla. Despite the damage and a certain amount of opposition, only a few of our sailors were wounded or hurt, none seriously. No soldiers were casualties during the whole landing operations. The assault craft from the David fared less well. Only one of their LCAs made it back, I believe, and several soldiers were killed. The group from the Henry fared better, only losing one LCA. I think it's, and I like to note the looking back, the certain things stick in my mind very strongly. The state of morale and training of our soldiers was, to us, outstanding. They were, of course, eager to get out of the LCIs for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. Despite the squalor of their trip, and that's about the only word I can use that describes it, because they were seasick and they couldn't come up on deck, and it was pretty ghastly. Mm-hmm. They were friendly and cheerful, and they were really very calm in view of what they were about to face. And I know that the North Nevers had a hell of a time shortly afterwards. They had a tremendous number of casualties. I look back and wonder, really, at the effectiveness of our green young sailors, who managed within a very few months to make our small LCIs into remarkably efficient and effective units, despite mm-hmm. the fact that they were very inexperienced and the young officers who were leading them were very inexperienced. Mm-hmm. It worked, and I guess we were about the smallest cog in the largest war machine ever assembled, but in my view was, I guess, very much a microcosm, but nothing else shaking happened to us. But I still have a feeling of awe that I had all through the few days of the operation, and the incredible planning and leadership that made it a success. Mm-hmm. It was incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're going up onto the beach, what was going through your mind at this time? I mean, you mentioned that there wasn't an overwhelming amount of fire, but yet there was.
There was some.
Yeah.
Curiously enough, I don't remember being scared, and I don't say that in any feeling of bravado. I say it with a certain feeling of wonder, really, because I'm normally a fairly timid person. But I don't remember being scared. I think that we, all of us, I guess, and I certainly, were so anxious to do it right. And there wasn't time, as far as I was concerned, to be scared. We just, as I say, I forgot to drop the catch, but apart from that, it was a textbook mm-hmm. landing, as far as I was concerned, and everything went fine. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we got pushed over that we actually banged into some mines. But everybody did what they were supposed to do, and it's the old story. You get enough training in how to do things, you do them. Mm-hmm. And it's just training. Mm-hmm. And the ability to respond to this glitches that are inevitably going to happen in an operation like that. From our viewpoint, as I say, which was a very lowly one, things went very well. I'm sure there were all sorts of horror stories, but in terms of mistakes, but I don't think there were many. And from our point of view, people did their jobs and did them well. And it's really incredible when you think, I think, what was I, 23 or 22 or something, and 23, just turned 23. And I was one of the oldest people on the ship. Mm. So, it's hard to imagine when you think of the responsibility that was thrown on all of us from the lowest seaman on up mm-hmm. to handle themselves and handle themselves well. And I don't think the Canadians at that time had to take a back seat to anybody. I think we did better than most.
Mm. Now, to move on a little bit, after this, after your ship's gone in dry dock, what happened?
Yeah, well, I found out very quickly why the ship was put into dry dock, because then, of course, the ferrying problem of troops came up. Mm-hmm. And they got into, I wasn't involved in this because I was in the dry dock, but very shortly after D-Day, if you recall, another hideous storm hit, and in fact, they lost one of the Mulberries.
Yeah.
And there became a very serious problem of getting the troops back, and of the three flotillas of Canadian LCIs, anything that could move was moving and running back and forth. And as soon as we got out, which was, I think, 2 weeks later or whatever it was, we were moving. And believe me, we humped back and forth across that channel as fast as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And then we used to go into the Mulberries to offload and sometimes onto the beaches. And the resupply problem, which was troops as far as we were concerned,
yeah,
and bringing back wounded,
mm-hmm,
was a significant one. And then, you know, after things calmed down a little, and funnily enough, I can't sort of remember the time sequence, but by about October, we were pretty well finished. We didn't get involved. We thought we were going to be involved in the Scheldt landings up in Holland. And in fact, we were sort of looking forward to it, because we all thought we were pretty hot stuff at this point. However, we didn't get involved, and although a lot of Canadians were involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we, later on, I think it was in November, it must have been late October, we paid the ships off. And most of us were lucky enough to get home for a couple of weeks' leave. And then I went back to the UK, and landing craft, of course, were finished, and I didn't particularly want to go into corvettes at this stage because, well, I just didn't. I liked the rather freer, more breezy life of the combined ops, and as it happened, I went into with the RN and became a spare CO in an MTB flotilla down in Lowestoft, where I didn't get any action at all, hardly. I don't think I did. I think I did two patrols or something. But then the end of the war came, and I was in Lowestoft on VE Day.
Mm-hmm. So following after VE Day, you were sent back to Canada?
Yeah, I came back, yes, I got back here by August, I think, yeah.
And then we were mentioning, discussing a little bit off tape, that you were discharged but then eventually returned to the Navy.
Yeah, I spent about, I had gotten married on my leave back from the UK,
mm-hmm,
and my wife was in Vancouver, and so I got sent back to Vancouver, and they kept me in for about 6 months. I, even then, thought it'd be kind of nice to join the regular force. I liked the Navy very much, and but my wife wasn't very keen, and so I left the Navy for 2 or 3 years, and then when the Korean War came up, I'd kept my affiliation with the Navy through the reserve. I was in the active reserve. By this time, we'd come to Victoria. And when the Korean War came, a number of us were asked to come back in, which I did, and transferred to the regular force and stayed in. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd do the whole thing again.
Well,
it was great.
When you rejoined during the Korean War, you weren't anywhere in the Korean War.
No, I was not sent to Korea. That really what people like myself, I guess, were called back with for was to actually, because I was out of practice, let's face it. I'd been in the active reserve, but it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the technical side and so on, I was well behind.
Mm-hmm.
What we were brought back in for was to man the posts that
to free up other people to
go off in our destroyers,
mm-hmm,
to Korea. And then I, having been accepted back into the RCN, as a matter of fact, I was asked by the Director of Officer Personnel, who was David Groose, who was quite well known, who I'd gone to school with, actually, to St. Michael's. And David suggested I should apply to rejoin. He eventually became our Member of Parliament for Victoria here. Died of cancer a few years ago, fine man. Anyway, I was then sent off for what turned out to be a 14-month course to get me back into up to flying speed, so to speak, and then away we went.
What were the changes that you noticed between, say, 1941 and 1950?
Oh, well, of course, you know, a regular forces in peacetime is quite different to a reserve force in wartime. There was much more structure to the organization. There was much more professionalism. And I guess those are the two main big differences. There really is no comparison, because during wartime there's a certain sense of chaos, I guess, to everything that goes on, because there's so many people and people aren't ever ready for things and so on. And there's a lot of excitement and so on. But in peacetime, it's a much more... And the Canadian Navy is a very professional organization, very highly trained, very professional organization, despite the present ghastly state of the ships. At that time, everything was very optimistic, because we were just starting to build the new ships, which are now the old ships, which were very advanced for their time, and everybody was feeling very upbeat and very excited and happy about their professional life. And fortunately, that's managed to keep up. I don't know how long they can keep it up. I have great admiration for the leaders who are managing to keep it flow now.
Well, then, briefly, what did your naval career encompass from this point onwards?
I was very lucky, actually. I had some good jobs. I had, let me see, I had five commands, two minesweepers, two destroyers, and an AOR, the protector.
On the West Coast?
No, on the East Coast. Okay. One minesweeper out here. Mm-hmm. Rest all on the East Coast. And I had some excellent, what I thought were excellent, shore jobs. I had the leadership school for 2 years in Cornwallis. I was executive officer of the old HMCS Stadacona, which is now Canadian Forces Base Stadacona. I had three tours in Ottawa, which I wasn't so keen on, but which were interesting and certainly educational. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up as base commander in Halifax, and then to get my last 2 years, I persuaded a benevolent Navy to move me to Victoria. Mm-hmm. So I was base commander here for 2 years.
And then you retired?
I retired here.
Mm-hmm. There any? No. What year did you retire?
75. Mm-hmm. Or was it 76? Can't remember. 75 or 76.
One topic.
76, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm. One topic that, of course, I don't think we can afford to ignore is that of integration and unification. Mm-hmm. How did that affect you and your jobs, your positions at the time?
Yeah, I was the executive officer of HMCS Stadacona, which is the biggest base in Canada at the time, which is the number two person in the old naval structure. The executive officer was sort of the vice president, executive vice president, I guess, with the commanding officer being the president, chief executive officer. Right at this time when it happened, I think I can give you my own personal sort of feelings about it. First of all, Admiral Landymore was the flag officer on the East Coast at the time, a man for whom I had tremendous admiration and respect, still do. And he mustered us all. I was captain of a destroyer just before this, and he mustered us all when this started to break, and then I got moved up to the barracks halfway through it. But he mustered all the commanders and above and told us what he was going to do, and that he was going to resist it and do his best to see if he could stop it as far as the Navy was concerned. Mm-hmm. And he nearly made it, you know. He nearly made it. I don't think people realize how close he came to it. He actually, I believe, had an interview with Mr. Pearson, who was the Prime Minister at the time, and so on. But, of course, he didn't win. But at the time, he told us that there was no use anybody below his rank doing anything. And his message, in essence, was, look, this is what I'm going to do, but I don't want you guys doing it. And somebody's got to look after the store, and eventually it'll work out, but don't want anybody else. But I think what happened, a lot of more junior people did get out, and for all sorts of good reasons, and, you know, I think we all had sort of agonized over it. I personally had, and I don't recall exactly what my conditions were in my own mind, but I had a sort of chalk line in my mind beyond which I couldn't see myself going. But I stayed, as did, of course, most of the people. And I think it's done us almost irreparable harm, personally, for the Navy. Now, I can't speak for the other two forces. I wouldn't be right to to do that. You can't, I think you tamper with tradition and the way things are done at your peril if you don't have something else to replace it with. And we had nothing else to replace it with. And who was it once described tradition as the link between the dead and the unborn? And it's not a bad description. Some of our traditions weren't very good, I'm first to admit it. But one very important one that was that we inherited, and this is Hinton speaking, I may be, get all sorts of argument from other people, but I believe that we inherited one wonderful tradition as officers in the Canadian Navy. We inherited the tradition of intellectual dissent. And it's a curious, almost a paradoxical thing that we were allowed to exercise our minds to criticize and to come up with new ideas and challenge old ideas. And we all somehow learned when to stop. In other words, at a certain point, somebody's going to say, look, shut up, for God's sake, and get on with your work. And that's fair enough. Certainly, I've had to do it as I got more senior, and I've had it happen to me many times when I was more junior. And to me, it's a sign of maturity and security in an organization, a good feeling about itself, that it can afford to allow that kind of thing. The other forces may have had that. I don't know. I've never seen it in them because I haven't worked closely enough with them. But we've lost it. And it's, to a very large extent, I believe we've lost it. I think that was a serious thing to lose. If you're going to get into the real guts of an organization, what makes it go in some of its principles and its ethics and the way it looks at life, mm-hmm. apart from the actual technique of doing the job, I think that's something we lost. We lost our identity to a very large extent, and I just don't think that works. I can remember the then chief of the armed forces saying that, well, we no longer are loyal to our regiments or our squadrons or our ships. We're loyal to Canada. Well, that is absolute rubbish. Of course we're loyal to Canada, but people don't think about themselves as being loyal to Canada. You just are. People think in the Navy about themselves as being loyal to the guys in their mess and maybe 14 other people. And that's their first loyalty, then to their ship or whatever, and then, and you know, I'm damn sure it's true in the Army that there's the fighting soldier's loyal to his platoon, and then his regiment, and then his army, and then his country, maybe, but, and that's the sort of scale at which people are loyal. They're not loyal to some rather vague concept of being a Canadian. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just are a Canadian. So that I think has proven to be very, very difficult. And I just sort of feel that nobody quite knows where we are at the moment. I think I have some confidence it's going to come back. Mm-hmm. You know, if the armed forces are to, maybe they aren't useful anymore. I don't know. I have my own feelings about that, but I won't express them now. But assuming that things are going to go on and that we're going to get some more ships and that the Navy's going to be a viable force, mm-hmm. then I think it's coming back from what I observe. I was at sea recently in one of the destroyers, the captain of which was my ex-operations officer in a destroyer, and I was very impressed with their professionalism and with their cheerfulness and just the way they handled themselves. It was good, the morale was good, and I guess the ship is typical, I don't know, but I thought I was impressed. I'm very impressed with the caliber of people, the officers and the young sailors. Just terrific.
Well. Now, in 1970, when Trudeau rearranged all the priorities, and we had the cutback in NATO, that type of thing, how did that affect? Were you at sea? Were you kept?
This is in 71.
71.
Yeah, I was just coming ashore actually, and I had the Protector, which is a large supply ship, mm-hmm. and I came from there to be chief of staff to the. Fleet in Halifax. No, it didn't really, to the best of my memory and the best of my knowledge, because at that, you know, if you're living in Ottawa, if you're working in Ottawa, you get involved in the discussion and the politics surrounding major policy decisions. If you're down at the coast or in your regiment or whatever, I think you're more inclined to say, what effect does it have on, you know, my ship or my squadron or whatever. And I don't really think it seemed to have an effect on us at the time. And I don't recall any, because it seems to me, and I may be wrong in this, but didn't Wasn't Mr. Trudeau, didn't he walk back on a lot of the things that he had said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I think there were some other influences brought to bear, to the best of my knowledge at the time. Some of the stories that we heard, that he was made more aware of the trade implications and a few things like that, other that were not purely military.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The stories that we heard that came out of Brussels indicated that.
So I guess in retrospect, after what, you have roughly what you had 25.
No, I had about 35 years altogether.
Do you have any comments to sum up your long naval career?
Oh, just that I enjoyed it. There's many facets of it that I enjoyed. I'm a fairly restless person, and I enjoyed the fact that in the Navy you got changed jobs every now and then, and if you didn't like your boss this time, when you might find one you like next time, so to speak. I can't really recall having any bosses that I didn't get along with. My only memory is basically that I enjoyed it. I found it a very demanding profession to be in. It's a 24-hour day, 7-day a week profession as you get older. And but I like the people. I think they're much more liberal in their views and intellectually active than most people give them credit. I'd do it all again. I'd like to just walk back on something I said a minute ago, though. I don't believe that unification did us irreparable harm. It damn nearly did. But I think somehow we're pulling out of it a little bit.
Well, somebody, I can't remember who it was, said that it would last 20 years. No, it's 20 years now. And it is beginning to mellow out a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's interesting what happens. Going back to the flag debate,
mm-hmm.
I happen to be one of the ones who strongly supported the new flag. And one of the reasons that I was, at the time I was captain of a destroyer, and I think we were probably the first official Canadian organization to hoist a flag, because we were just going to join the first NATO squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And we were half a day out of Plymouth. We were told that we were to change flags, take down the white ensign, and hoist the new Canadian flag at noon. Well, we were scheduled to be in Plymouth at noon, and there was no way I was going to do it and make a gratuitous insult to my friends in the Royal Navy. So we had a ceremony that morning at 8 o'clock, and a very nice ceremony it was. And I definitely got the sense of how important the sailors felt, the young sailors felt, this identity was. Now, I, of course, was older and grew up with the white ensign, and that meant a great deal to me. I'd fought under it and all that old BS. But the sailors really liked it, and I agreed with them. It set us apart. We were no longer something else. And I really get quite tired of my colleagues who are perpetually saying, let's go back to the white ensign, and wearing white ensigns on their car and stuff like this. I think it's rubbish. I think you have to put certain things back behind you, and they were fine at the time, but times have changed, and to a certain extent the uniform thing was the same. I have no brief for that wretched green uniform at all. It's apart from everything else, it's hot in the summer and cold in the winter, and it looks terrible, and it's out of date, and it's just ghastly, it's cheap and nasty. But I think we were ready for a change of uniform. Not that one.
Yeah.
And we were certainly ready for a change of uniform. Once again, identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our people have earned their identity. We have enough of our own traditions. We have enough of our own abilities now. We don't have to be dropping things too fast. I think we have to develop our own way. And I think we've done it. We just, unfortunately, that uniform thing, I think, has been sour.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what a lot of people, I was talking to one fellow whose pet theory is, and it's probably true, is that integration is essentially a way of making that final break with British tradition. You know, we sort of started in a military sense in the late 40s, and then this fellow, particular fellow, suggests that it was just, the liberals just wanted to break with that British,
I think he's wrong.
Yeah.
I think he's quite wrong. I don't think that was the motive. It may have done it, but I'm damn sure that wasn't the motive.
Mm.
I went to Ottawa shortly after the integration, while it was still going, of the unification, it wasn't integration, and went into a director's job in Ottawa. And in fact, my job was director of manpower programming and control, a rather grand title, which said that I was presiding over the cuts mm-hmm. of position. Mm-hmm. Position cuts, not the people side of it, but yeah. weeding out, God knows, 40,000 positions out of the Navy, both civilian and service. And so I had a fair amount of access, and I had a totally unified staff. In other words, Air Force, Army, Navy, all in equal proportions. And, you know, I don't want to give the impression for 1 minute that I think they're less effective or less efficient than naval officers. Mm-hmm. They're not. They're very able people. They come at things differently because of their backgrounds and the, you know, the disciplinary needs are different in the Army than they are in the Air Force than they are in the Navy. And we've all started run things our own way because that's the best way to run them over the years. That's been decided. And so I have nothing but the profoundest respect for these people. But getting back to this motivation thing, I don't think that's the reason at all. I think it was purely a political move on the part of the minister at the time, Mr. Hellyer. I make no bones about this. He was politically very, very ambitious, as he's proven by his subsequent actions. Mm-hmm. And if you, I've always found it very interesting in Ottawa to observe the interplay between the politician, the cabinet minister, and the civil servant. And most cabinet members, to my view, use their ministerial position as a membership card to the cabinet. It's not terribly important which department they're in, and they don't really get involved in it very much, except a few. And Hellyer was one of those. Very able man in some respects, no question, very clever man. But I'm absolutely certain that he had his eyes set on the leadership of the party. I'm certain that he decided that this was the way to go, that he was going to make his name, make his mark on the country. He was actively, and I know this for a fact, actively encouraged by certain senior officers, who I obviously am not going to name, who really believed that this was the way to go for whatever motive. Some of them rather shaky motives, in my view. But I'm damn sure that's the reason he went with it, and once he started, he just got stubborn. Now, to me, Hellyer has proven by his almost irrational act since in political terms that he is not a very rational man, and something we all rather guessed at the time. And he treated some people extremely shabbily. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did the unification and this affect you when you were at sea and meeting up with other...
You mean the uniforms?
The uniforms and
Oh, well, you know, people were polite in a sense, but they also were amused by the whole thing. And those who were frank enough to express their opinions thought it was a load of hogwash, and still do. The Americans did a very careful study of this years ago and decided it was just nonsense.
Unification?
Yeah, sure, yeah. And, you know, other forces have done the same thing, and they've looked and said, well, this is preposterous. It's like saying that doctors and dentists should be interchangeable. Yeah. You call them both doctor, but they have different functions, and they're not interchangeable. And it was carried to ridiculous extremes. The chief of the defense staff was advocating sending, I can remember a friend of mine who was a captain at the time, he was a naval aviator with a general service background, was proposed as captain of an army base, you know, which was purely army in an operational sense, and it was only with the greatest of expostulation on his part that he managed to get out of it. I mean, it was just patently nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's like sending me off to run a regiment. I wouldn't know the first idea how to do it. Mm-hmm. And to think that people are interchangeable in any sense is ridiculous. You can take the logistics side and so on. We all know all about that. But looking at the most important thing, which is the operational, the sharp end side, and this is often forgotten by people in Ottawa because they never see the sharp
yeah.
end,
yeah.
you can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't ask a helicopter pilot to fly at sea and on land because it's two different
functions. That's right. You can, you know, his basic training as a helicopter
yeah.
driver can be moved either way, but
yeah.
That hasn't worked very well.
So you would suggest that the fighting effectiveness as a whole has been diminished?
No, I think it was in grave danger of it,
yeah.
but thank God the senior officers of the three services managed to withstand this nonsense
mm-hmm.
and keep almost, I think, against the wishes of the government, managed to keep their identities separate. Mm-hmm. We made a few clangers, I think. We had some people at sea, for instance, that should never have come to sea, this kind of thing, but it was relatively unimportant in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it in that sense that it's hurt the operational effectiveness. The other thing, there's always been inter-service bickering and inter-service rivalry as far as budgets are concerned, obviously. And I don't believe that's got any better. In fact, I think it's got worse from my observation. I may be wrong because I haven't served in Ottawa for many years, but it seems to me that that kind of rivalry and bickering has not gotten better, and that was one of the great things that was supposed to be a result, a beneficial result of all this nonsense that went on, is that inter-service rivalry would somehow be diminished. Well, it wasn't. It never will be. It's always going to be there, and that's what the cabinet is there to decide, and the minister and the senior deputy ministers. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the chiefs of the three services are going to fight. I think that there has been, and once again, I can't speak for the other forces. The Navy has, I believe, lost its voice to a certain extent in Ottawa. The command structure is not ideal anymore, I don't believe. But I really shouldn't comment on this, and I'd rather not, because I don't know about it anymore. Mm-hmm. I used to know about it and I used to be current. I'm not current mm-hmm. anymore, and it's quite wrong for me to comment as to whether the new uniform is right or not. I don't know whether it's right. Ask the people in the service now, they'll tell you. I could have told you 15 years ago when I was still in. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, things change, and I think it's quite wrong for retired people to be rushing around trying to get the old uniform back, and that I think it's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think your comment about the Navy's lack of, shall we say in Ottawa, is probably, if it is true, would be due entirely to the fact that the Navy is based in what is the peripheral areas of Canada as opposed to Ontario, Quebec. And
well, that's what I mean by the command structure, yeah. You see, that the chief of the naval staff. So-called, who was the head Navy guy, used to be in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And he had two operational commanders who reported to him, and he had a staff, a vice chief and a staff in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And he was one of three equals, mm-hmm. the three chiefs,
yeah.
Who had their own mechanisms for cooperation in various committee structures and so on. But that's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. And I believe that you've got to have your chief guy in Ottawa, mm-hmm. where he's no longer in the operational side of it. He's got to be there with his technical and his operations people, mm-hmm. and let the commands operate the ships and the aircraft that belong to them.
Well, turning the thing around, do you see any positive attributes to this anywhere?
Not really. Some. I don't know how important they are. Certainly from a personal point of view, I appreciate that I learned an awful lot more about the other services and thus gained more respect. Mm-hmm. I was never disrespectful about them, but I got to know them individually better and at my level, and began to appreciate their methods and so on. And in fact, I think we learned quite a lot in the logistics side, mm-hmm. From the other two services, that things that we could adapt to our own service, and I think hopefully we've been smart enough to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, none of us know everything. Mm-hmm. I can't honestly think of anything else. Mm-hmm. There may be things that I don't know about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you still keep up any relations with the Navy, going and visiting?
No, only when invited. I just believe that the day you take your uniform off, your rank no longer means anything, and you better drop it. And on the whole, they're awfully polite, and I get invited out to lunch every now and then, and for the odd day at sea and do a mess dinner. It's great. I love it. Mm. But no, I stopped that the day I left the dockyard.
Mm. Well, is there any topic or anything that we haven't covered that you'd like
to... Oh, God, no. I've been pontificating away like crazy here. As I say, I must emphasize that I think the kind of support retired people should be giving the Navy is, if possible, at the political level. And on that sort of level, and trying to drum up enthusiasm in the community for support for new ships, for instance. And the times that we spend fussing around as to whether the uniform should be this or that, or whether we should have the white ensign and so on, I'm sure it's enjoyable to the people who enjoy it. I don't happen to, and I think it's a waste of time. Mm-hmm. I don't believe you can live in the past. The guys who are in the service now know better than I do, as I say, what kind of uniform they need, or mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well,